Hello, I'm Lisa O'Neill, and you're listening to The Matriarchitects. The Matriarchitects podcast and platform highlights changemakers who are building a culture that respects, values, and celebrates women. These individuals and their stories offer an antidote to the hard times we live in, showing us that new ways of seeing and being are not only possible, but are already here. Thanks for joining us. Let's build together. Today on The Matriarchitects, we have an interview with Nishtha Mehra. Nishtha is the author of the new book, Brown, White, Black, An American Family at the Intersection of Race, Gender, Sexuality, and Religion. We talked about her book, interracial adoption, gender fluidity, and hair, the gender expectations around it, cutting it all off, and learning to do her child's hair from YouTube videos. Nishtha also discussed the need for other communities of color to work against anti-Blackness, and both the frustration and the freedom of making it up as you go along when you're navigating intersecting identities.
So, Nishtha, I'm so excited to talk with you today.
Yes, I am excited also. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So, to begin, you have a new book out, which I've read and is so amazing, and it's called Brown, White, Black, An American Family at the Intersection of Race, Gender, Sexuality, and Religion. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how this book came into being.
Sure. So this book for me is very much a group process in terms of how it came into even conception and then certainly into fruition. So I was blogging and at the time had started to write a little bit more about my family. My blog was ostensibly a food blog, but like a lot of food blogs was also a narrative, a personal narrative in a lot of ways. And so as Shiv got older and sort of we were intersecting with different issues and realities, I started sharing more on the blog about our family life. And a good friend of mine from graduate school reached out at some point and said, you know, have you thought about writing more about these things, you know, beyond the blog? And so she worked with me on an essay that eventually got published online with Guernica. And it's actually one of the essays that's now in the book. It's Black is the Color of My True Love's Hair. So that was the beginning of really thinking about, oh, I do actually have a lot of stuff to say here on these topics and kind of exploring those more and more fully. And then that essay actually caught the attention of the woman who became my editor at Picador. So it was really kind of a very organic and also, like I said, very much a group project in the sense that I'm so lucky to have people who have been cheering me on and really supportive of this work. And you know, often I think other people can see our stories and the value of them sometimes even before we can. So I'm really grateful to those women for championing my voice in that way.
Yeah, that's so great. And that was Isha Sabatini Sloan.
Yes, who I know we both know.
We both know. And I love that piece. I loved it, you know, when it came out originally and then as it is in the book. So in Black is the Color of My True Love's Hair, which, as you said, was published originally as a standalone piece and is now part of the book, one of the things that I picked up that you wrote about is the hesitation of adopting and raising a Black child in the culture that routinely threatens, harms, and kills people that are Black in our society through police brutality and just through an overall institutional racism that continues within the country. And I sense that part of that was not having the lived experience, either you or your wife, Jill. Like, how would you prepare this child for that? And how would you also bear that, bear seeing your child face that kind of prejudice and threat? And so I'm wondering if that's right, or if you could talk a little bit more about that experience and what you wrote about there.
I honestly have to say that I don't know that we were anticipating nearly as much as we've felt. That so much of this journey has been learning what we didn't know we didn't know. you know, I think that we knew that there was a huge gap, obviously, in our lived experience. And there was a hesitation, I think, in the sense that we knew that there was something very specific and important about the Black experience in America that we don't have first-person experience of. And we didn't want to screw up. You know, I know that's a fear of parenting on a lot of levels. And of course, we're always going to make mistakes. And, you know, I always like to joke that our kids need something to tell their therapist. So, I mean, you know, you certainly try not to make the big mistakes, and you try to be really thoughtful in how you approach parenting. And you know that you're not going to get it perfect. But this was a thing, right? We really didn't want to be these ignorant, quote unquote, colorblind parents who, you know, brought our child into a family that they didn't ask to be a part of and raise them in ignorance, right? Or raise them with some sort of Pollyanna-ish view of how the world was going to work because it would be more comfortable for us or because it would mean that we wouldn't have to push or challenge ourselves to look at or think about things that we maybe wouldn't ever have had to look at had we not adopted Shiv. I mean, I certainly hope that we would have. We certainly had started that process, but there's no way to compare really before Shiv and after Shiv, right? Those are huge categories of change for us. And so the work really was knowing that we would, there were things we weren't going to know and that we were going to have to be very humble and patient with ourselves, but also willing to push ourselves and to learn, right? And to seek out resources. And that couldn't be optional, I guess, is the main thing that we were really clear on, that it wasn't going to be optional once we became parents of a Black child. And so, you know, I hesitate to say that we were anticipating all of it because we didn't know the half of it, right? We had some inkling, but then, you know, we adopted Shiv pre-Trayvon, right? Sort of pre that conversation about Black Lives Matter that became such a public part of the discourse. So it became very clear to us very quickly that, you know, our inklings were right and that there was so much more to it and so much more for us to learn.
So what have been some things that you all have engaged with as a way to parent the best way possible given our current culture, which is transforming but in need of more radical change?
Absolutely. Well, we're both readers and scholars, and so I think that is certainly, we tried to use those things to our advantage in the sense of, you know, just doing our research, best practices, doing our research and seeking out good sources. And we're very lucky to have a diverse group of family and friends with whom we were already in conversation, right, about these kinds of issues. But honestly, just seeking out media that for which we were not the intended audience, I find it really useful to pay attention to what folks are doing and saying and reading in spaces that they've sort of carved out and cultivated for themselves. So what is the conversation that is curated by and for Black folks in America, right? How are they responding to media and how are they responding to pop culture? And of course, it's not a monolith, right? And that's the other thing that's super important, right? Shiv could have been adopted by a Black family and could have been adopted by any number of Black families and would not have ended up with the same lived experience at the end of that journey, right? So knowing that, but also just knowing that there is a certain thing, a sense or a certain degree to which you can't access stuff from outside. And so trying to do our best to pay attention to the kinds of things and the kinds of conversations happening inside that sector of American society, and then making sure that Shiv had access to media that reflected her and reflected people who looked like her and reflected the experiences of people who looked like her. So, you know, it's certainly not, we're still learning how to do that. I'm grateful every day for the women who post videos about hair on YouTube, because that is the only way that we have managed to, you know, not go broke and help Shiv sort of cultivate the look that she wants and keep her hair natural and healthy and do interesting things with it. So I've actually gotten a pretty decent cornrow down. I'm very proud of that. It's passable. And honestly, right, like things like YouTube, as silly as that sound, make that possible. Like there's a wealth of knowledge out there that folks are just sharing very generously.
And you write also in the book about Shiv's relationship to gender,
And I'm wondering about the navigation of helping your child self-express in the way that she feels most comfortable and most true to herself, and also protecting her from a world where so many people still act out against people who are gender nonconforming in some way.
This is something that is increasingly a topic of conversation for us as Shiv gets older. I think in many ways, she has been protected simply just out of her age, right? There's a little bit more grace afforded to younger kids in our culture. Certainly, we still have a very binary way of thinking about gender. You know, all you have to do is walk down the toy aisle at Target. But there's sort of a little bit of room given to experimentation or play with sort of this idea that kids are going to grow out of it, of course, right? That's the other side of that piece. But Shiv is physically bigger than a lot of kids her age. She's a really tall kid, and so she looks a lot older. And so as that has become a thing that she now is sometimes mistaken for an 8 or a 9 or even a 10-year-old when she's only 6 and a half, it's a reality that, like you said, we have to be aware of and have to make her aware of to the extent that it is a navigation. You don't want to pretend that the world is other than it is in a way that's going to perhaps set your child up to be extra vulnerable or unprotected or unprepared. But I also want certain things to be possible that maybe are only just possible now. You know, I don't want to have to tell my kid, you can't do this. We don't have space for this in the world that we live in. She has this bold and sort of daring sense of herself where for her to be who she is, there's no block in her mind about that, right? Every once in a while, of course, you know, things crop up and she'll have some sort of doubts or fears. But for the most part, she feels really clear on who she is and how she wants to express herself in the world. And so not getting in the way of that, like you said, while also trying to be aware of realities is something that we're still learning to balance and navigate. So we have conversations with Shiv kind of on an as-needed basis. When things come up or when she's maybe entering a new situation or a new experience, we'll sort of talk through what the logistics might look like and ask her how she feels or what she thinks about it. But certainly as she gets older and is more independent and is navigating more spaces without us, that will be more and more at the forefront of our minds, thinking about how that works.
And Nishta, where did you learn messages about what femininity meant?
So I went to an all-girls school growing up, which was really much more empowering than people sort of tend to assume. I think people hear that and they maybe think of really catty, competitive, bratty, whatever.
I went to an all-girls school too, so I can relate.
You get it, right? But yeah. I think there is this negative stereotype maybe from movies or TV. I don't know where it comes from exactly, but it was interesting how when it was just us, we were focused mostly on school, honestly, and less so on, you know, sort of the stereotypical quote unquote, you know, girl thing that middle or high school girls are sort of said to be obsessed with. So there was not a lot of focus on appearance. We did not have a uniform. So many of us just kind of showed up in whatever was relatively comfortable. And we were mostly focused on our academics or whatever sort of passions or interests we had. We cheerleaded each other, and we still do. I mean, I've heard from several of the women I went to school with who are so supportive and who've bought my book and who have been encouraging since we went to school together. So I think there was certainly more of a range and more of a diversity in terms of what femininity could look like in that space. You know, they were really strong, talented athletes that I went to school with, women who went to college on athletic scholarships. There were just ridiculously smart women who, you know, could do math thinking that I could barely understand, right? There were performers. There were all kinds of women. And so that was really empowering for me, that I knew that there wasn't just one way to be female. And I'm super grateful for that. Now, that being said, it was also the 90s in Memphis, Tennessee. So the diversity itself was a narrower range than I think certainly I now feel or think or experience in terms of what I think about what it might mean to be female or what I would want for us to have a range. But given the context, I would say that I definitely had access to more of a variety than maybe other people did.
What about in the context of your home and your family?
Sure. So being an only child and growing up sort of with a lot of chosen family, I think my main struggle with femininity had to do with outward appearance and attractiveness and body image, like a lot of women, right? It was clear to me that while women could and should do all kinds of things with their minds and their intellect and their physical capabilities, there was a limit to the amount of praise or recognition you would receive if you weren't also beautiful or conventionally attractive, on top of whatever other accomplishments you might have. So that was a message that I think was not just from like sort of my home environment or immediate community, but also certainly out in pop culture and just in, I don't know, the air we breathe, right? It just seems so pervasive. This is something I really appreciated that Janet Mott talked about in one of her memoirs, Redefining Realness, that she really acknowledges her own privilege when it comes to sort of meeting conventional beauty standards as a woman and the level of privilege that brings, even though, right, she faces so many other areas of her life where she's not in a privileged position, that outward attractiveness does bring a kind of privilege where you get to move through the world in a certain way. And that was something I think I was acutely aware of when I was younger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she talks about it in terms of how many trans women of color and trans women in general are unable to successfully pass, and mm-hmm. the privilege that gives her, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah.
And also the money that sometimes is required for that to happen, you know?
Absolutely.
And so it also becomes an issue of class too. Yeah.
You know, another thing that I was thinking about that you write about in the book.
You talk about being in Memphis and, you know, having, you say, like a chosen family of different immigrants, Indian immigrants who became like a chosen family, but also being in a community that was pretty white.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so
yeah.
Can you talk about writing that part of the book?
Sure. I think the biggest thing for me that I really had to look at and reckon with was the extent to which it was almost like there was a third circle missing in the Venn diagram, right? There was the white community that I spent a lot of time in through school and then through many of my friends that I made. And then there was this brown community that I was my sort of family of origin and the family we built. And that was my sort of safe space and my home base in a lot of ways. And we often talked about or sort of related to how those different communities intersected, and our parents were very clear about, you know, why they had put us in those schools, and, you know, were clear about what we were navigating to a certain extent. They knew kind of as much as they could what they were putting us into. They couldn't relate because they were all immigrants, so that was an experience that they had never had. But they were clear that they were prioritizing our education and sort of doing what they thought was best, and that this other stuff we would kind of figure out how to navigate. And to a certain extent, there was conversation in my white community about, you know, diversity or difference and things like that. But sort of the gaping hole in the third circle of that diagram that really didn't get filled in until I was embarrassingly much older was any conversation about how either one of those communities interacted with the Black community in Memphis. It was sort of this constant near presence that we didn't talk about. I think I had done some reckoning with how that worked in the white environment that I had gone to school with, in terms of thinking of, you know, how we did or didn't talk about race in that space and what was maybe missing and what I was frustrated by and about. But I hadn't really done as much reckoning in terms of thinking about our privilege as immigrants who were very much fell into the category of model minority, sort of did immigration right, and who in many ways had an imitative experience of, you know, what success looked like that was very white and very class privileged and very heterosexual. That work of really digging into and thinking about the Asian American community's complicitness in anti-Black racism simply by virtue of being part of this conversation that is America, right? Was work that I was, you know, ashamed to not have done sooner. And I'm really grateful to the folks who have pushed that conversation to the forefront and who are insisting that we have it. Because I, again, I don't think it's optional. I think we as a community have to speak out against anti-Black racism with the same fervor that we would speak out against racism directed towards our community. And so that work was, I think, some of the most meaningful for me in terms of really coming to terms with and being present to some things that I really had not dug into as much as I should have before writing this book.
And is that, that makes me think of, too, of your mom. And is that something that you all have been able to talk about, especially now that she has a grandchild who's Black?
Yes, it is something that we've been able to talk about. I think that for her, the experience is very visceral, sort of, which is maybe a grandmother thing, right? Sort of the instant, I don't know, mountain lion protectiveness that happens, right, when the second, I'll never forget when my mom held Shiv in her arms for the first time. It's definitely one of the best things I've ever witnessed in my life. And so that instant, like, you know, sort of what is almost like a light switch, I think, going off, then of course has to be supported and sort of pushed further by reading, learning, conversation, and examination. And so we have had really meaningful conversations both about race and about gender in light of Shiv coming into our life and pushing us to think about and examine these things. And my mom has proven really adept in a way that I think a lot of folks her age, and even not her age, are sometimes not, in terms of being willing to examine her own thinking and to see things differently and to understand things in a new way. And that is, I think, just a powerful example of how we can keep our thinking flexible and we can be willing to say, this is something I didn't see before, and now that I see it, I'm going to act differently in response to it or think about it differently. So she is an amazing model to me in that way. Absolutely.
What I was struck most by when I was reading the book, beyond the compassion and thoughtfulness that you bring to everything you're talking about, is just how many different aspects of identity are at play in terms of both your experience growing up and also in creating your family and navigating the world. And I think it felt like such a gift to me in that way, because I feel like so many people can relate to, you know, different intersections of identities and creating family, but not having representation of what that looks like when there's all of these different pieces. And so maybe can you talk a little bit about that? I'm also just thinking about organization and things like that in relationship to the book when you're taking on so much material.
Yeah, it's funny. Sometimes people will ask, you know, how did you figure out what to put in the book or what not to say? And, you know, certainly when writing about family and or children, it's a tricky thing. And at some point for us, it's almost not tricky, just because I can't write about anything without writing about everything. And, you know, that's not to say that there aren't boundaries. There's certainly things that I don't talk about that are private and that are not relevant, right, for the purpose of the things that I want to discuss in the book. But you pull one thread, right, and they're all connected. And so there's no way I could write about race and not write about sexuality. And there's no way I could write about sexuality and not write about gender expression. And there's no way I could write about adoption without writing about race, right? It's just this whole interconnected, because it all informs our experience. And so I think for me, that really struck me when writing the book, that we sometimes, I think, this sort of idea that to talk about these things is somehow, you know, pushing an agenda or, you know, whatever people will want to say about it, right? Like I knew that I disagreed with that intellectually. And then in the space of writing the book, it was a very powerful experience for me to say, that's a thesis argument, right? Like this, there's no way that I can even begin to speak about my life without speaking about these categories of identity, because there is no me without talking about those things and how they are represented or not represented in the broader world. So I'm hopeful that folks will also have the experience, like you said, of being able to identify with the messiness and the complication, and then also the joy that I think comes when you don't necessarily have a model. It can be very frustrating and it can be very discouraging, I think, especially when you're younger. And that's why I do think representation is important. But I also think that, you know, as we break or push against or challenge or twist more norms, right, there is a freedom that comes when you get to make stuff up or experiment and play with what feels right to you and not necessarily have to go into a default setting first, realize that it doesn't work for you, and then find something else. And that's what I would hope for anyone, regardless of what categories of belonging they ascribe to. It's not just those of us who fall into categories like me who would benefit for us having more room. It's everybody, right? Everybody benefits if we have more options and more pathways. And that's a thing I think that we sometimes miss in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk about one of those moments of joy that comes out of, you know, navigating without a playbook at the intersection of all these identities?
Sure. Yeah. I think a recent one that comes to mind, we're now in Phoenix and we're new here, so we're getting to know different communities and different groups of people. And we've been very lucky that Shiv's going to a great school and we've met some really welcoming folks. And we actually, Jill and I had a conversation earlier in the year about Kwanzaa and sort of bringing up Kwanzaa and thinking about how do we want to approach that with Shiv. It's not a holiday that we have celebrated yet as a family. And, you know, there's always this question of, is it going to feel forced, right? Is it our place to sort of step in and say, let's celebrate Kwanzaa because you're Black? Because there are lots of Black families who don't celebrate Kwanzaa, and there are some Black families who do, and, you know, all of those questions, right? And so, as it happens, we got invited to a Kwanzaa celebration by a really good friend of Shiv's mom. And so we said, okay, great, perfect opportunity for Shiv to be exposed to this and to sort of see, right, what this is about, and if this is something that she's interested in exploring further, we can go down that road with her. But we really try to follow Shiv's lead as much as we can. So we go to this celebration, wonderful, warm house. Shiv's friend's mom is just the loveliest person, and she's one of those people who draws interesting people to her. So we're in this house full of just interesting educators and artists, and there's kids running around everywhere, and they, you know, they've got beautiful cloth for the kids to tie in headdresses or wraps, and we're learning about the principles of Kwanzaa, and then the children are invited to share a piece of creativity. And Shiv, because she loves to perform, decides that she's going to do a dance. And so she gets up to dance, and she's so natural in her body and joyful in her expression. She's in a room full of people we mostly don't know and just dancing, and it's just stunning. And we were so proud. And at one point, I looked around and I whispered in Jill's ear, I said, you are the only white person here. And she was like, I know, isn't it great? And it was just that moment of, one, for me being very grateful to be partnered with someone who gets it. Mm-hmm. And two, that just so grateful that Shiv was having an experience of being in a space where she was in the majority and we, her parents, were in the minority. And that she was clearly expressing how comfortable she felt in that space by getting up to dance, right, and being joyful in that space. And so I just thought, yeah, there's no way you could plan this. There's no way you could sort of chart a course for this, right? It's sort of about having some principles in place and being open and moving forward in as much good faith as you can. And it's kind of constantly coming back to, does this match what we said we would do, right? And should we prioritize this based on what we said matters to us about raising Shiv and about being family? And so there's a lot more room in that metric than there is in checking against someone else's clipboard or, you know, worrying about how it measures up with what other people are doing or how we were raised ourselves or anything like that. We stumble into these experiences that I think we have access to. One, because we're very lucky, right? And some of it just has to be that, right? We're just very grateful for the places we've gotten to move around in. And I know that a lot of it is the just something that we've cultivated, right, or that we try to cultivate that allows us access to these spaces or to these moments.
Mm-hmm. And what the word that came to mind when you were describing that experience just now and your relationship to it was freedom. It feels like so much freedom.
That's what we hope.
Yeah.
For. Yeah. That's what we hope for Shiv to have. I mean, as much as we can, right, for her to have an experience of herself as a free person. And that has to start with us, right, and how we relate to her as an autonomous being, as someone who does not belong to us.
Right. And how you relate to yourselves, too, right?
Sure.
Directing that same level of love and affection and acceptance yourselves.
Yes. It is so funny, you know, that people say that cliche thing about, oh, you know, your children teach you so much. And I just always kind of rolled my eyes at that. And then, you know, having a child, I really think the more accurate version of it is it actually comes from Jon Kabat-Zinn, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
His version of that, and I'm paraphrasing. I mean, I get the wording exactly right, but he says that having a baby is like having a tiny Zen master parachuted into your life. And it's so right. It's so disruptive in this sort of fundamental way. And I think that there's a choice there, right, to be disrupted in a way that feels chaotic and frenetic and, you know, sort of ultimately just really frustrating. And, you know, of course, that goes without saying, right? Like, we had a healthy child who did not have complications and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Or there's a way of saying everything is disrupted. That means that sort of all bets are off, right? And the amount to which Shiv pulls me into the present is such a gift, because I am someone who can so easily get all up in my head and be anxious about things that may or may not happen. And Shiv's like, Mama, dance party, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that, and then also the extent to which, right, she'll internalize things that we've taught her, and then she throws it right back at us. That's the dangerous part, right? It is wonderful, right? She'll totally call me out the other day. This was just this weekend. I was doing something. I was getting ready, and I was fussing over something about how my hair looked or my makeup. I can't remember. And she looks at me. She goes, Mama, remember, it doesn't have to be perfect. And I was just like, okay, all right. Thank you, wise one. You know, like, it's just like that parenting came right out of her mouth right back at me. And so that is such a gift for me in that sense, that it's like, right, she's forcing me to live more authentically. It's like, I can't just say that I believe this for you, but then not do it for myself. And to that extent, it definitely has caused me, I think, to live with more integrity.
One piece that stands out to me, another piece in your book, you write about your relationship to your hair. And I think, I think so many women or people who are raised or socialized as women can relate to that. Like, it's such a, how you do your hair, how much effort you're supposed to put in your hair, how your hair is supposed to say something about you or signify your level of attractiveness or whatever. And you talk about, you know, the decision at different points in your life to grow your hair and the decision to shave your head. And it seems to me that, you know, a lot of that also relates to your relationship with queerness and also religion and also your father who passed away, as I remember, not too long after you had come out. Is that right? Mm-hmm. So you never fully got to be in relationship with him with a different understanding of your queerness versus it being this like new thing. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about that journey with your hair in relationship to those different aspects of your life.
So I don't know if it's all Indian American women, but I know for me, hair was sort of even more of a thing, if that's possible, than just for all.
Well, you were also growing up in the South.
Right.
Like,
women is all ready for all women. Yeah. I mean, I had very few classmates who had short hair, certainly not until we got to high school. Everybody's hair was long. Long hair was just the norm. And my dad would always he always wanted me to have long hair. It was sort of like a running joke between us that at some point, like, wasn't a joke anymore, because he really did want me to have long hair, and I was really annoyed that he kept asking me about it. And so, you know, it was this push-pull of, again, being aware that my attractiveness was always part of the equation, sort of no matter how well I was doing in school or how much I was a good kid, you know, it didn't matter. This other piece was always there. And I definitely resented that.
Mm.
And it was something I felt like I couldn't live up to. Sort of even if I did have, or when I did have long hair, you know, it was, there was something else that, you know, wouldn't be right about me, or that wouldn't sort of fit the mold of, you know, conventional attractiveness. And so I think part of cutting my hair short, which is what I did in high school, was just kind of throwing that off and saying, like, I don't even want to deal with this anymore. You know, let's just throw the rubric out. And that was definitely liberating. Certainly still had, you know, the feelings and the questions and the wondering and the all of that about whether or not I was attractive, or if people would find me attractive, or if I was letting go of that. Could I ever let go of that fully, et cetera? But I was spending less time thinking about it. And it, what was interesting, and what I think has always been interesting to me, is that when I cut my hair, I get much more attention and many more compliments from women than I do from men.
Huh.
And that is so interesting to me still, right? That so many women will say, I love your hair, it looks great on you. And then also, right, what I get is, I wish I could do that. That seems so easy. It would be so nice not to have to deal with my hair all the time. That tends to be the sort of the line of commentary I get from women, from my people my students' age, women my students' age, to women my mom's age. And so I think that says a lot about, you know, how gendered our hair still is culturally, mm-hmm. for us, and how fraught it is as a form of self-expression. Now, certainly for many people, right, it's a joyful and exciting form of self-expression, but it also is very labor intensive, right? For folks with longer hair, or with hair that requires, you know, a certain amount of maintenance or product or whatever. At this point for me, it's two things. One, it's sheer convenience, in the sense that now that I don't spend that money or buy those products or pay for haircuts or any of those things, it's really hard to think about going back to it. It's hard to talk myself into that. And then the other part of it is that when I do think about going back to it, I'm clear that my motivation is about being read in different ways and being seen as more conventionally attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I resist the desire to grow my hair back out, because I know that that's what's motivating it. It's not just because I want to. I'll also be seen more sort of conventionally as Indian, right? I often get these sort of looks from folks when I'm out in public, often folks that I'm reading as also being sort of fellow, either sort of Indian immigrants or first generation, second generation folks, who sort of who'll see that I'm wearing a bindi, right? And but then see the really short hair and sort of do this kind of double take, and there's this like sort of calculus happening of, can she be possibly this when this thing doesn't match? And so I really resist the temptation to grow my hair back out, because I know that I'm motivated by these things that have been there my whole life that I've been trying to fight against.
Right.
That, and, you know, nowadays I spend a lot of time on Shiv's hair. So it's good to just have one less head of hair to deal with. It's my own at this point. So,
yeah. It's so real, though. It goes back to what you were saying about women can be smart, they can be accomplished and all of these ways, but there are still ways in which the ultimate measurement is around beauty, right? Which
mm-hmm.
is so disappointing.
It is really disappointing. And I notice it in myself. You know, I mean, I, mm-hmm. again, one of those things that I often am calling my own, you know, sort of inner judgments out on is just those snap sort of default responses, or those assumptions, or those categorizations that are based on, you know, just literally only having looked at someone. And I, you know, so disappointing for me, and also such a reminder of how like viscerally powerful that conditioning is.
Right.
Even
it's so ingrained.
It's so ingrained.
Now that the book is in the hands of people who are engaging with it and making meaning on their own end,
mm-hmm.
What is your biggest hope for the book in the world?
That's a great question. So I think one of my biggest hopes is selfish, which is that I want to learn stuff. I want certainly I hope that people will learn things when they read the book, and then when they're maybe in conversation with people in their lives about the book, or that it will spark a conversation or spark a place to talk about something that they haven't talked about before. But I'm also excited to learn from readers and learn from folks who I end up being in conversation with or whose work I will also read. This book is not, for me, a sense of like, look at what I've figured out. It's really about, this is what I think I've figured out so far, and I know that I have a lot more stuff to figure out, and I'm interested in being in conversation about that. That is a big hope that I have. And that we just, I think if we can give each other and ourselves some more space, that includes me, right, to be engaged in the inquiry and to not feel like we have to figure it all out, because that, I think, is just a recipe for us feeling despair, right, that because it's never going to be sort of an end point. It can be very gratifying to be engaged in that work as a sense of a continuous posture just towards the world. So for all of us to just be reminded that this work is important and it's worth doing. It's not that we're going to necessarily solve something or fix something, right? But that we can maybe enrich or deepen something else, and that we can maybe also give each other some more space and more compassion and see each other more fully, with maybe a little less fear behind it or a little less need to categorize or box in. That would be that's a big hope, I guess. But that, if I'm going to dream big, then if the book can be part of any kind of conversation like that, that would be very gratifying.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's like the book as being part of a community that is doing this work and supporting people in the process of growing and expanding. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if we have a few minutes left, and I'm wondering if there's anything that we haven't talked about so far that feels important to, that you'd like to discuss.
You know, one of the things that I'm thinking about a lot right now, mostly because I'm around my students, right?
Who are high school
students. Most of the time. They're high school students. You know, I teach at a primarily upper middle class, affluent private school, right? I do have students who are not part of that demographic, who are here on scholarship and things like that. But the environment itself is very high achieving in that sort of stereotypical way of how we define success and college bound and all of that. And I just have been thinking a lot about how we teach and what we teach and how what we teach and what we don't teach ties in with, you know, all these conversations we're having in the news right now about, you know, the rise of anti-Semitism and, you know, whether or not it's okay to wear blackface and the fact that we're actually debating that in our public discourse. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking a lot and talking a lot with my students, to be perfectly honest, about what they've learned and when and how it's been taught and just how much we shy away from difficulty in the classroom. And, you know, I think there are a lot of reasons for that. Certainly, I would never begrudge a teacher who was already overworked and underpaid and who's being pushed to teach to a test, right, in a classroom full of 30-something, 40 students, right? So there's that to begin with, right? But I think what we don't necessarily always see or talk about when we're talking about that conversation about our schools or this system and the ways in which it is failing kids is that it's also failing us inside of these larger conversations, because we're not engaging in this really difficult work. We're not giving students a safe place to practice those kinds of difficult conversations. And so it's not strange to me that we're bad at it in public when we're talking about a bunch of adults, right? Or that we don't have facility to really engage with these things that it's so important for us to engage in. And I'm thinking a lot as an educator, and I'm lucky to have other educators to talk to and learn from about this. You know, how do we do this better? How can we serve our students to really think about and be with these very hard things? And how do we give ourselves the resources and the self-care, honestly, as sort of cliche as that sounds, right, it can be very draining to prep and come in and do five sessions of a class where you're going to talk about, you know, othering and genocide, right? And, mm-hmm. you know, what else am I, if I have the freedom in my classroom, which I'm lucky to do, right, like if I'm not asking my students and myself to look at this material and think about how to think about it, you know, what else am I doing? Or why am I in this classroom with these kids? And so that's something that I've been thinking about a lot, and that I've been trying to draw connections with my students, because they're also concerned, you know, they're concerned about what they see and concerned about navigating those kinds of conversations in college and in the world around them, right? And so equipping them better is something that I feel really called to do.
And I think we also don't give them enough credit sometimes for having, and by them I mean like young people, but, you know, I mean even children in mm-hmm. terms of like grammar school or junior high kids in addition to high school students. Like, I think we don't always recognize that they're already thinking about these things.
Absolutely.
And that they have way more capacity. If we can create a container that is safe and supportive for them to talk about these things, they have way more capacity than they're often given credit for.
That's so right. They want to be engaged in this kind of work. They really crave it. And, you know, so sometimes a conversation, you know, that we're all checking about something that happened in the news, or, you know, we'll look at a photograph together, that can easily become half of a class period, right? Because they're thinking about it, and they want to engage, and they want to do right. You know, they're very concerned about what kinds of people they want to be. And so I agree with you. I think even in my experience with Shiv and, you know, her friends and younger kids around her age, right, what they're able to hold in their minds, I think, is often so much more than we give them credit for.
Thank you to Nishta Mehra for joining me for this episode of The Matriarchitects. See the show notes for links to her new book and her essay, Black is the Color of My True Love's Hair. Thank you also to songwriter Jillian Bissette, whose voice you hear at the beginning and end of our show. I'm Lisa O'Neill. Thanks so much for joining us and listening to The Matriarchitects. You can subscribe to get new episodes delivered to your listening platform, and you can support the project by sharing this episode, leaving a review, or finding The Matriarchitects on Patreon. Let's continue to build a world where people of all genders can live their fullest, most purposeful lives. See you next time.